part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2006 lecture series presents Zoot Suit Riots Revisited, Meditations on the Politics of Style by Katie Pice, on Tuesday, October 25th at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. This lecture revisits the Zoot Suit as clothing and as a cultural and political symbol. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer, on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The last time John Katz was a guest on the program, we talked about how the work of dogs has become more and more about giving emotional support to us humans. John Katz's book, The New Work of Dogs, had just been published. His latest book is also about the canine-human connection. It's a guide to training and living with dogs called Katz on Dogs. Dogs have been part of John Katz's life for his entire life. But it wasn't until Orson entered his life that his life with dogs changed in a big way. Katz says Orson changed him profoundly. Orson was, to quote Katz, a frenetic, bothersome border collie who was in deep trouble and at first seemed untrainable, at least by me. But Katz loved that dog, and he knew he had to do something for Orson and for himself. Today, John Katz has three dogs, two border collies, Orson and Rose, and a yellow lab named Clementine. He loves them dearly, but he is quick to point out that he is, in his words, eager to keep them from taking it over, taking his life over completely, or warping my perspective. He says, I adore dogs, but they are not substitutes for humans. Listeners, I welcome your questions about dogs for John Katz this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. John Katz is the author of 14 books. He's written for many publications. He writes a column about dogs for Slate, and he is the co-host of a monthly radio show on dogs on Northeast Public Radio. His new book, Katz on Dogs, A Common Sense Guide to Training and Living with Dogs, is published by Villard, and he joins us this afternoon from Chicago, where later this evening he'll be in Downers Grove, the suburb of Downers Grove, for a talk and signing at Anderson's Bookshop. And then he'll be back in the Chicago area on Thursday. He'll be in Skokie at Barnes & Noble for a talk and signing. That event set for 7:30 Thursday, this evening's event at 7 o'clock this evening at Anderson's. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Sure. Well, tell us more about Orson, Rose, and Clem and your very different relationship with each of them.
Well, I have to tell you, there's been a new addition in the recent
years. Yeah?
Yes. Pearl.
Pearl.
Another yellow lab who is a bit in trouble, a show dog who needs surgery. It's come to be at least temporarily.
Yeah.
So the place is filling up.
I have
donkeys and sheep now, too.
So it really is Bedlam Farm.
Bedlam. It's Bedlam. Yeah. Well, they're very different dogs. You know, Orson, of course, whom the Katz on Dogs is dedicated, actually. I kind of belatedly realized that he rescued me. When he came into my life, I was living in New Jersey and writing about technology and was kind of restless. And now I'm writing about dogs, and I'm on a farm in upstate New York, and things he's changed quite a bit about my life.
Yeah, never know where life's going to take you.
Well, I mean, and Rose, the other border collie, of course, runs the farm, and I've been sheep herding with her. And Clementine is, of course, a simpler creature. She's a yellow lab, and she's mostly, you know, I write about her in my next book, Dog Days, and I call her the Whore of Bedlam Farm, because she basically would go live with anybody who offered her a biscuit. She's just all sweetness and food.
Yeah.
So it's great. It's a, you know, I've really, as a writer, been changed quite a bit by it, because I'm mostly fascinated by the people who own dogs and what they feel, and I feel that way because of the impact these dogs had on me in order to keep them, train them, work with them. I realized how little I knew about dogs, how much I wanted to learn, needed to learn, and how fascinating what I call the emotional geography is between people and their dogs and pets, cats and horses too.
Yeah, yeah. You say one of the most important things you've learned to teach your dogs is how to do nothing, how to remain calm and at ease. A couple of questions here. Why is that important, and when and how did you discover that was so important?
Well, you know, a lot of people talk, sometimes I think we love the dogs most who give us the most trouble, you know, and I've met people at signings and email and in person who, they're just crazy about these demented animals like mine. And I think because it challenges us, challenges our humanity in a very particular way. When you have a troubled dog who you love, you just really have no choice but to be better, be a better person, be more patient, learn more. And that was a very powerful experience for me, because the dogs gave me an opportunity to take on some issues that have just troubled me my whole life, like a lot of people have: impatience, frustration, anger. And you just really can't have a long relationship with a dog if you don't work on those issues. I also found that the process of training a dog, living with a dog, was really not about obedience. It doesn't really matter if the dog sits or drops to the ground, like the Discovery Channel. It's an almost spiritual communication. It's a relationship that is very powerful, perhaps the most closest of any two species. So living with a dog is a tough thing to do well, and a very powerful thing when done well. But I realized that me, like a lot of people, didn't really know a lot about dogs when I found myself in this particular position. So my choice was to learn more or to get rid of the dog, which I did not want to do. I did not expect the experience to be as powerful, really, though.
Yeah. Orson, at first you say he seemed untrainable. What was he like, and when did things begin to improve? Where did you start?
Well, he was just taking my neighborhood apart along with my house. He was herding school buses and jumping on top of cars and jumping through windows and raiding the refrigerator and hiding food in the house. You know, he was just making me and everybody around me crazy. I think when it changed was when I really began realizing that I was dealing with a simple animal, really. Maybe not simple, an animal, and not a adolescent, not a teenager, not a person. The more I humanized him, I think the more problems I was having in communicating with him. The more I came to understand his true nature, which is, you know, that of a intense, instinctive animal, then all of a sudden it was possible to train him and to work with him and to calm him down. You know, you mentioned calming training. Calming is very, very important for dogs, because when trained dogs are calm dogs, they're dogs at peace. They're less likely to hurt dogs. They're less likely to hurt people. They're the dogs that kind of weave themselves most harmoniously into our lives. And untrained dogs are anxious and confused and can cause trouble. They can chew things. They can bite people. They can have accidents in the house. So I think one of the ideas that dawned on me as I began working with trainers and working with my own dogs especially was to do this basic work of a dog, grounding training, calming training, crate training, to show the dog how to be peaceful with me. Very important as a writer when I turn on the computer. You know, I don't want to know I even have a dog, and my dogs just plop to the ground, and they respect my work, and they do it with me, which is beautiful, very powerful for me. But I also, as I go around the country, as I talk to people, I don't see very many calm dogs, and I don't hear about many calm dogs. Mostly what people tell me is their dogs are frenetic, out of control. And quite often this is described to me in very human terms. The dog is angry, the dog is anxious, the dog is spiteful. And this was the same problem I was having with Orson. I was seeing him as a kind of earlier version of me, as a rebellious, obnoxious teenager. and not as just a very confused animal. It was a wonderful animal, but just was confused. And I the pressure was really on me to figure out how to communicate rather than blame him for being in trouble. And that was a big breakthrough for me. And so two things happened. I learned more about dogs and how they think and react, and got very involved in training and became a trainer. And the second thing was that I came to realize that the more I saw him for what he really was, which was not a human, the better our training went. So things, I wouldn't say he's quite calm, but he's certainly calmed down.
Yeah.
And we certainly, the difference is extraordinary. You know, he is capable of great calm for periods of time, and yeah. So am I.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. You have to be calm as his owner, his master.
Exactly. The great moment that I will never forget was I was yelling at him. I took him to a sheep herding trainer. I was always yelling at him because he was always driving me crazy. He was always, you know, he was herding school buses and skateboarders and dogs. And this trainer, who I really became a good friend, I was trying to get him to lie down around sheep, unsuccessfully. And I remember him coming up to me and just wagging a finger in my face and saying, you know, cats, I'm afraid the only way you're going to have a better dog is if you become a better human. Which I was not expecting to hear from a trainer. But it was true, clearly true. And I realized I had to calm down.
Mm-hmm.
I had to be more patient. I had to be clearer. I had to, you know, to just settle down myself. And as I did, so did he.
Yeah.
He was really picking up these cues for me.
Yeah. Well, that's a tall order.
Very tall order. Although but loving a dog, loving an animal, you know, people will do amazing things for the love of an animal that
sure.
they may not be able to do otherwise.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it was very, because if I didn't do it, I would not have been able to keep him. And so the incentive for me was very powerful. I wanted to keep him. I wanted to do right by him. And so issues that, I'm not saying I, you know, cured all of my issues in life, but he made a lot of progress for me that I might not have made, you know, on my own.
Yeah. Was it a way of going back? You said he was, you know, this rebel, and you were, you know, thinking back to your teen years. And it, was it an opportunity for you through the bond with Orson to rework that part of your life?
It was. I was slow to see it until I realized that I was projecting a lot of issues from my adolescence onto him. A lot of my anger about, mm-hmm. you know, I, like a lot of people, had a complex family and had been working to try to put those issues behind me, and probably was not quite as far along as I thought I was. And he, you know, I mean, it is always wonderful to have this incentive to continue at any age to be better, to improve, to take on issues in your life, and not to just give up and say, well, you know, I'm in my 50s, it doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the dog gave me a motive to do it, and I found that I was not done. You know, you're never done, really. And one of the things, if you have a dog, I think, and your eyes and ears are open, you realize you're never done, and you keep improving.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, to live well with a dog requires some of that.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be as, you know, as pain in the butt as Orson. You know, even to train Clementine, who's a much simpler creature, to socialize her, to train. She's a big, strong dog, and you see a lot of labs running around. People describe them as hyper. They're jumping all over the place. And I wanted her to have the same sense of peacefulness, and she does. So, I mean, it's symbiotic. I think the work I do with her, of course, benefits me. And again, the process of coming to some clarity about what I was dealing with. You know, it's very natural to anthropomorphize a dog, to attribute human thought. I mean, in Cats on Dogs, I write about a theory of mind, which is about our human tendency to attribute our thought processes to animals. Now, dogs think, of course, but they don't think the way we think. And when we assume that they do, I think we get very confused, and they get very confused. And which is why these neurotic behavioral problems among dogs are so epidemic now.
We got to get in touch with dogness.
Exactly. Well, I happen to love dogs because they're not like people. And I have no... They don't go on cable talk shows and scream at each other. They don't have guile and you know, they don't betray us. And they're very faithful and devoted. And that's what I love about them. And I don't I don't quite understand the rationale for turning them into little people. You know, I think it's not what's wonderful about them, and it's not what I happen to really love about them.
Yeah. Well, one of the most important questions to ask if you're contemplating adopting an animal is why do you want a dog or a cat? Or
it's very important, especially, you know, as you mentioned, new work of dogs, and I got very involved in attachment theory as to why people are attaching themselves to. The numbers of pets in the United States are staggering. I mean, there are now 70 million owned dogs in the U.S. and 10 million in the shelter system. In 1960, there were 15 million owned dogs. And there's at least that many cats, and not to mention horses and ferrets and everything else. And you have to ask yourself, well, what's happening? You know, what does this say about our society and about our culture that we're turning to animals in these kinds of numbers? And there's quite a bit of research about the fact that we are in many ways an existentially lonely people. It's hard to connect with people in our culture. People are online. They're watching television. They're busy. They're harried at work. Their families have moved away. The sense of community can be fragile. The sense of security at work can be fragile. So pets are something you can count on, something you know is going to be in the house and will love you regardless of what you look like or how you did at work or whether you wrote something stupid or whether you smell bad. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, I love to come home, as many people do, and see these creatures who are just thrilled beyond words to see me. That's a lovely thing. But, of course, like everything powerful, it has to be managed. I mean, it has a downside and requires some thought and care. But I think a lot of us, you know, get dogs because we want something like that to trust. Sometimes because an impulse, we see something cute or we want to rescue something and we want something for our kids. Those reasons are, I think, not as grounded.
Yeah. You know, we've lived with dogs for a very long time. They've helped us herd and hunt, and they've served to protect us. And they've always been companions, but not like we count on them today to fulfill that role for us. Is there a point where we can say, here's when it started to happen, when we started to ask of dogs more and more for companionship and emotional support?
Yes, actually, it started to happen in the 60s when the divorce rate began to climb and when the interstate highways made the country more mobile and families began to move away from each other, when people started moving around to the suburbs, when the idea of the flexible workplace began, you know, layoffs and changing work strategies and corporatization. And, of course, one of the major factors that it's quite striking, the rise of dogs and pets corresponds almost precisely with the rise in television. Because as Americans now spend 3 to 5 hours a night in front of a screen, that's just television plus the Internet and everything else. And there was a decline in common spaces. You know, there were just really fewer and fewer places where people could go to meet each other. It's quite common in the suburbs for people not to know who their neighbors are at all. So their life became more complicated. There was the rise of the technological culture in which, you know, customer service does not mean service and tech support does not mean support. And life became more complicated. It just became tougher. I think people found that in many cases politics and technology was not uplifting them in the way they expected. Quite the opposite. So I think there was a great need for something to depend on, something that would love you no matter what, something to you could see as your soulmate that you could attach to, that was a fixed point. And I think it was very striking. I mean, you can see the numbers begin to shoot up with the changes in the workplace, the rise in television, and the mobility of the family as people began to move away from one another.
Mm. At that same point, do we see the beginning of a rise in dogs in need of rescue or dogs at shelters?
Well, we certainly see a change in the way people viewed dogs. You know, people used to just, 25 years ago, people just went to a shelter and got a dog. They never used the term rescue.
Right.
And rescue, of course, is a very charged word. It's different from adopt. And then, of course, there are people who buy dogs and the whole rescue experience, which is enormous in the United States, is very emotionally charged. There are nobody has exact figures, but there are believed to be many tens of thousands of people who are involved actively in dog rescue, acquiring abused or mistreated dogs, moving them from place to place, driving them around the country, finding new homes for them. But, of course, we live in a culture in which there's no people rescue. And it doesn't mean dog rescue is a bad thing, but it says something about us as a culture that I think is very interesting, that this is a very new phenomenon, this sort of vast, you know, the Internet has helped fuel it. Mm. But I think it also speaks to our need to do good. I think it's hard to help people. And if dogs are more savable in many ways. You can get hold of one that's in trouble. You can get it to another house. You can move it around and keep an eye on it. You can feel you've done, you can feel and you have done something valuable. I think it's harder to sometimes for people to affect that kind of change in the other world.
Mm. That idea of rescue, though, underlying it, does it also signify, does it also mean that we are realizing that what we have now, what we now expect of dogs, it's difficult, if not impossible, for them to meet some of our expectations?
There are a lot of alarming signs about the pressure dogs are under. There are hundreds of thousands of dogs, I think more than 350,000, on medication now for depression and anxiety, which is disturbing to me. Behavioral problems are now the leading cause of death for dogs. More dogs are put down for behavioral problems than for any, you know, for illness now. The number of dog bites is up epidemically. It's increasing more than 47%, I think, a year. That's what the number of dog bites going up. And those are all, I think, signs that, you know, dogs are being acquired very impulsively and very intensely, but people often don't know what to do with them when they get them. Mm. They don't quite know how to train them. They don't know how to interpret their behavior. They're getting dogs whose histories are unknown to them in many cases. Dogs can be genetically damaged. They can be traumatized in the litter. You know, it's very hard to know. Dogs are very alien creatures, even though we see them increasingly as human-like. They're not, and I think there is a lot of pressure on dogs to be soulmates and to read our minds and know our secrets and lift our spirits up. And I think when dogs are put in situations they don't understand, that's when behavioral problems generally start to pop out.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is John Katz. His latest book, Cats on Dogs, A Common Sense Guide to Training and Living with Dogs. John is also the author of the new work of Dogs, A Dog Year, and The Dogs of Bedlam Farm. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. So where do we begin? What should we think about when we begin thinking about bringing a dog into our lives?
Well, you asked, I think, the first and the most important question is, why do I want a dog?
Mm.
And there's, of course, no one single answer, but it's an important thing to think about. Other questions, how much time do I have? How are my neighbors going to feel? Who's going to train this dog? What kind of a breed should I choose? What characteristics should I look for? How much exercise does it need? And how much of a commitment do I want to make to a dog that, you know, real dogs, of course, are not like the dogs we see on television, the Disney dogs and the TV dogs. Mm-hmm. Those dogs are not like my dogs. They don't have diarrhea. They don't go to the bathroom. They don't smell. They don't bring disgusting things into the house. But real dogs do all of those things, and there is also, and this became a big issue for me in the new book, is I think a crisis in the sort of whole idea of training a dog. According to the American Veterinary Association, only 3-5% of Americans train their dogs at all.
I couldn't believe that.
I was pretty surprised. But of course, when you think about it, how many well-trained dogs do you know? You know, when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. I mean, you hardly ever meet a well-trained dog. And by well-trained, I don't mean, you know, a show dog who has to snap too. I just mean a dog who has been through the process of grounding and comes, sits, stays, and behaves. So I think there's, you know, there's a misperception. There's an idea in our culture. We have a very impulsive culture. You can just go out and get a dog. You saw a movie. A kid wants a dog. You went to the mall. You want to rescue a dog. And so people tend to not really think about it and just bring a dog home. And then they often find that their expectations were just too high. And a lot of dogs come back or get into worse trouble. So I think this idea that you can sort of train a dog in 2 or 3 weeks with 4 or 5 hours of obedience class is also just not so.
Mm.
And, you know, I think people who understand what they're getting into and have a commitment to it can pull it off. But because I worked on this book with 30 volunteers, people who had, you know, training problems they couldn't find books to solve. You know, I think that there's a great misperception about training, you know, that it's really about sitting. But it isn't. It's about your language with the dog. It's about your dog's ability to live in the world. It's about having a dog that is calm enough to train and grounded enough to train. And then showing that dog how to live well in our world, how to be appropriate with dogs, appropriate with people, not to jump on us, not to chew things, not to eat the furniture.
Yeah.
And so that we can end up with a life of what I call a harmonious life with dogs, a dog, you know, which should be a life that is peaceful and loving and very satisfying to both sides. And that's, you know, that's, and unfortunately, you know, it's a tough thing to do. And I think it's doable. I think almost anybody can do it. But I think it helps to know that you're involved in a substantial process that's not going to be over in 2 or 3 weeks. It really goes on through the whole life of the dog.
That's interesting because you say in this new book, we are always in training. You know, the border collies and the lab. You're always in training, even if you aren't, you say, explicitly having a training session.
I think training should go on all the time. I mean, I love the training maximum. Never give a dog anything for free.
Yeah.
And it's a good rule. You know, when we go outside, we sit down first, and then we go out. And the dogs don't run me over to plow out the door. You know, when we get to a street, we stop. We respect the street. And, you know, I've trained Clementine, my lab puppy, for months about the street. She's quite good. The other day, a deer pops up right across the road, and she just goes flying across the road. And, you know, that will happen. I mean, you know, mistakes will happen. They'll lose it. They'll forget. You know, it takes about 2,000 repetitions before a dog really gets a behavior. And, you know, she wasn't trying to thwart me or be devious or difficult. She just got excited. And so that's what, you know, process of training is forever. I think there's no point really in a dog's life where you can say, this is absolutely done, I'm done. This dog is not, you know, there's always dogs to react to, traffic to react to, animals to react to, you know, people coming in and out of a house. So, and I think this process, you know, if you see it as just a, you know, an integral part of your daily life with the dog, you know, becomes less charged. I mean, it's going to take a long time. They're going to mess up. We're going to mess up. You know, I yell at my dogs. I mess up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, I just, okay, let's move on. You know, that's what I mean about also forcing me to be better. And I need to be the same with them. I need to understand this is a long and evolutionary process that, you know, is going to go on for years and years.
Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Indiana, on line 4 in Carlisle, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, I was listening to your program there. It's interesting. I like dogs really well. We have a 3-year-old golden retriever. And like you said, you're constantly training the dog. I mean, it's just part of the relationship. It's just like a relationship with a person, constantly work with them. And our dog does the same thing. He said about chasing the deer. We live across from the park in a busy state highway. Gets kind of busy there. And if there's a squirrel or a cat, she likes to run there. So I've been working with that. But the one question I have is she's had 2 litters of pups. Like I said, she's 3-year-old golden. And on our front deck, she's kind of calls that her own domain. People walk down the sidewalk and stuff, and she'll bark and show her teeth and her hair and everything. And you know, I used to play with her when she was a pup, you know, just kind of mess with her and tell her she's a little aggressive dog, a little mean dog and stuff like that. And I don't know, did I kind of mess her up there doing that? Or how can I break her from kind of, because it scares people to death when they try to get on our porch.
Sure. Well, I wouldn't say you messed her up, but it's a common thing, you know, as you probably know, you know, golden retrievers like labs,
mm-hmm.
you know, are beautiful dogs, and they tend to be very sweet, and they're the ones you see
mm-hmm.
on TV a lot. So we sort of forget that they're basically hunting and killing machines.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they are. I mean, you know, they're basically very much bred to hunt and run things down.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have to be careful how you play with them. And
okay,
when people
well.
Are doing a lot of ball throwing and tug-of-war and arm wrestling and rolling around,
mm-hmm.
it's play to the person, but it's hunting to the dog.
The son of the dog. That's what I was saying, the porch thing. Just kind of.
Yeah, well, it's not that hard to get out of. I mean, it's okay to do sometimes with puppies who are being socialized, but it's really never a good idea to crank a dog up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what you need to do now is just show her. Is it a she?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You want to show her how to calm down. I mean,
okay.
I most of the time I train my border collies to do nothing,
mm-hmm.
which is lie down and stay.
Well, see, now this dog here, I could take her outside by myself, you know, when nobody's around. And, you know, like I said, she's not aggressive even if the people are in the house. Like,
once
they get in the house, she's fine. But it's just like when she's on that deck and somebody tries to walk up the stairs, boy, she just goes right after him and it just scares him to death.
But that's where you want to do the training. I mean, that's a real good training opportunity because
what
you want to do is when you know, have some friends come over when you know they're coming.
Mm-hmm.
And get her in a lie. Right. Use a leash and step on the leash if you have to, but then start giving her food when she lies down and stays.
Okay.
And, you know, every time somebody comes up the deck, lie down, stay, throw a meatball at her.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd be amazed what a can of meatballs can do with a retriever. And if she starts thinking she's going to get a half a meatball whenever
she'll
somebody comes up
on
the deck, it's going to start to be a whole different game to her.
Well, like I said, I've got her trained pretty good just to stay in the yard. I start when she's a puppy, put her on a leash, and walk her up the street. And she'll walk right beside me, not really move. I just hold my hand out and say, stay with me, and she'll kind of stay. But like I said, if a squirrel or something like that, but that deck thing was kind of bothering me. So, hey, I appreciate it, and I'll get off there.
And also, you know, you expect this to take 6 or 7 months. I mean, it's going to take a while.
Yeah.
You know, it's just going to take a long time because you're really giving her a whole different tradition. So good luck with it.
Yeah. And routine is so important, too, isn't it?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, I call dogs the great stuff pots of the animal world. They love tradition. They love ritual. They love to do the same thing at the same time. And that's a great example of it. If a dog gets in the habit of, like, you know, dogs, for example, bark when delivery men come and people are always upset about it. Nothing makes a dog feel more successful than driving off an intruder. So if the mailman comes every day and the dog barks and the mailman goes away, the dog is just as happy as a dog can be because that, you know, the dog believes this, they're making this intruder leave. So it becomes a tradition, it becomes a habit. And it's a hard, you know, it's one of those habits that's hard to break. But you want to create a new tradition by just changing the whole behavior around people approaching the house. It's not easy.
Yeah. Well, we do here on this program once a month, John. I do a program with two dog trainers about training animals, and it's on the first Friday of the month. And this is an issue that comes up over and over again. And it's, you've got to recognize that the dog is doing what the dog does. It's saying, "Hey, there's an intruder," and then you say what my trainers say, Carol and Jim. They say you reward the dog. Thank you for telling me that information. And you've done your job. And, you know, approach it from the point of view of what is the dog doing and where do we go from here?
Well, and that's good. It's good advice. What I found in my, you know, it's interesting because I went around to some of these houses of my volunteers and what I would find, and this was something I had to check myself on. You know, dog lovers always are looking for gurus, you know, tell me what to do, tell me what to do. And, of course, I have a farm. I have a 110-acre farm, and I have fields and streams and meadows. So training a dog for me does not necessarily have a lot of relevance for somebody in, you know, in Urbana with two kids.
Right.
So, and I've said to people, you know, here's what to do when the UPS guy comes and the dog is bouncing off the wall. But what people tell me, and I think it's just a good caution for people like me to hear, is I know that's right. I understand that, but what happens is, you know, the dog goes flying, I grab the kid, the phone is ringing, something falls off the table, you know, and all this kind of planning falls apart. So we would be more creative and say, okay, maybe we need to change the environment. Maybe, you know, when the mailman comes, the dog needs to be in a crate, or the dog needs to be downstairs, or the dog needs to be in the backyard. Maybe you need to remove them. Because I think no training method is any better than the ability of the individual to carry it out. And so I think we give these general guidelines all the time, many of which are very good. I mean, it's very good advice. You know, you should do this, you should do that. But one of the things I argue in my book is that I think the reason people struggle so much with training is that these methods just don't always work for them. And you know, to really know how to train a dog like that, you have to know where the driveway is and where the dog is and the door is. Are there kids? Are there not kids? So I thought it was interesting for me. People came up with some very inventive ways of training their dog that I would never have thought of. And I would encourage people to do that. I mean, you do not have to be a trainer. I mean, you know your dog better than anybody. And you know what will get that dog to move or come or sit down. And that's what you sometimes need to do, even if it's not in a book.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Arthur, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hi. I have horses and have trained horses. I've trained and worked with large outside dogs like Border Collies, Labs, Aussies. No real problems. In fact, get along well. But we have this terrier that adopted us about 3 years ago. And we think she's a Jack Russell Chihuahua cross.
Ah.
yes. And, I mean, we love her to death, as you know, you've stated. And I agree with all the philosophies you have presented. I mean, I understand them. But our problems with her, I just can't quite address.
Yeah, no, tell me, what are some of them?
Well, primarily, it's when my husband goes to leave, she barks and tries to bite him. I mean, like playful bites, but nipping the heels and the toes and the whole works. And then when we have people come, guests, it just gets wild for a time until I can get her redirected with a chew toy or a treat or something like that.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. There are certain breeds, Jack Russells would be high among them, beagles, you know, that are real challenges to training because they're not all that eager to please people, and they're very bright. They're full of personality, and they're very feisty. I think in a case like that, you know, this dog obviously came to you as somewhat of a rescue, right?
Well, she just showed up looking in our basement window as a four-month-old puppy.
And terriers, as you know, are, of course, also working and hunting dogs. They're bred usually to hunt down small animals and dig them out of holes. So they have a lot of instinct, despite their size. I find a case like that, I would really change the environment, really, because you don't quite know what happened to the dog. So when your husband goes to work, I would put the dog in a crate.
Oh, okay.
Or when there's company, you know, you want to ask your, now, you know the dog, and I don't. If I had a dog like that, I would just probably keep it away from company until it's calm. You know, get it through the period of getting all excited. I would use a crate. I would use a kennel. I would give the dog an opportunity to be in an environment where, you know, he has to be still.
Okay.
But, you know, and as Celeste mentioned before, you want to create a new tradition. The tradition this dog is into is nipping after your husband, which is great fun, I'm sure.
Well, he thinks, yeah, and he aggravates it sometimes, so that doesn't help.
I'm sure, absolutely. So there, I mean, I would remove the dog from that situation completely.
Okay.
And just, you know, put the dog in a crate for the half an hour between your husband's getting ready to go and by the time he leaves, and the dog will, you know, come up with a new tradition over time.
Well, that's a very good suggestion.
Because terriers are the opposite of the dogs that you work with. You know, the border collies, especially when you raise them from puppyhood, they really want to work with you, and they have a history of working with you, and you've raised them. But a terrier comes to you, you know, we don't really know his past. It just might be simpler to change, be creative about the environment.
All right.
Probably faster. Good luck.
Well, thank you. And that's the advice I get when I tell people it's a terrier. Oh, good luck.
Yeah, I know. That's
you.
What I'm thinking.
Well, we will try that.
Good
Thanks
luck.
A lot.
I admire you.
Bye.
Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hello. I want to get back to your earlier comments about a lack of training in dogs, the increase in number of bites on dogs, the increased number of dogs that are on medications for behavioral issues and so forth. And I want to go at it a different way. I want to ask your reflections or thoughts on how we should respond as a general public with policies, because this is an increasing problem. You go to parks, people don't have their dogs on leashes. Everybody says, oh, my dog's never bitten anybody. And, of course, that's the next dog to bite somebody. So if you could just comment on that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
It's a great question. I'm glad, because I have, you know, I think a lot of dog lovers just do not want to face up to the moral responsibility of this issue. If you're not a dog owner, if you're not a dog lover, going to a park can be a nightmare. I mean, if 5 million people were bitten seriously enough to call the police, which is what happened last year, and you're walking in a park, how are you supposed to know who's a good dog and who isn't, or who's going to bite you and who isn't, or whether your kid is safe or not? So your instinct is, of course, to either want the dog to be segregated or not. So what's happened is we've just descended into this civic morass where dogs are being banned and restricted every place, the workplace, parks, you know, they can hardly run freely anywhere anymore. And there's some good reason for it, sadly. People don't clean up after dogs. They don't train dogs. Dog bites are way up. And so the people who do train their dogs and do take responsibility suffer for it, as do their dogs. Now, in America, as you know, Celeste, better than I do, every issue becomes polarized and bogs down in this sort of, you know, back and forth, back and forth. So there's no place I know of in the country that is rationally approaching this issue. I mean, it's just a very tough issue. Because it saddens me as a dog lover to say that I see a great increase in the number of dogs, but I don't see a great increase in people's willingness to take moral responsibility for them. I feel very strongly about this issue of dog violence on people. If my dog hurt someone, I would really have to very seriously consider putting them down, especially a child. You know, I just something I feel strongly about. I have to take responsibility for not hurting people. And that's, of course, a difficult issue for dog lovers, a controversial one. But I don't know of a community. You know, most people in the United States do not own dogs. About 52% are not dog owners. And they're quite upset. And my problem is I don't know what to tell them, because if I were walking in a park with my dogs, I'd be very careful. You know, I'm sad to say that, but I would.
Hmm. Why don't people train their dogs?
Because it's hard. I think they tend to get dogs for very impulsive, you know, we are a very impulsive society. And we'll go to the movies and grab a dog, or we'll see a dog in a shelter and we got to bring it home, must be rescued. Or our kids will badger us in a mall. Or we move to the suburbs and we go out and buy a 120-pound hunting dog, you know, as a puppy, not realizing that sweet lab puppy, a golden retriever puppy, is going to be a big dog in 6 months. It's going to need a lot of exercise and a lot of work. And trouble happens, and people are busy, and they're working long hours, and the kid who they bought the dog for is not walking the dog at 2 o'clock in the morning, but is on the computer. And so they don't know what to do. They don't have time. They don't have the will. They don't have the know-how. It's a tough situation for dogs, you know. And, of course, you know, dogs are also, many of them, quite well-treated and much loved. You know, I respect that, but this particular issue is worsening, because I think, to me, having a dog implies a great moral responsibility, and it's why I feel so strongly about training. I don't really care about the obedience aspect of it. I care about my dogs are dogs. I'm working very hard at this, that anybody can approach, and I do clean up after them, and I do train them, and they don't jump on people. And I think that's just taken a phenomenal amount of work, which is ongoing.
Yeah.
But I don't think people honestly know that when they get a dog, many people.
Talk a little bit more about the difference between training and obedience, because I'm maybe a little confused. Maybe others are a little confused, because if I have a dog, when I say sit, I want the dog to sit. If I say down, I want the dog down and stay. At a minimum, I want those things, and I'm going to work very hard at that. And to me, that's obedience. But, you know, what's the difference?
Well, I think it is obedience, absolutely. But I think the difference is really you're talking about your whole life with a dog.
Okay.
And you can get a dog to do almost anything if you really crack down hard enough. I ran into somebody at a reading who was housebreaking a puppy. And she was rubbing the dog's, you know, nose in the feces, as a lot of people do, and yelling no, 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 and throwing him outside. And she loved this dog quite a bit. She was a very, very nice person. And I don't doubt that she could eventually get that dog, you know, to go to the bathroom outside that way. But I said to her, you know, I just think it's so much more rewarding an experience to be a leader rather than a boss, that, you know, get a crate, put the dog in the crate, feed the dog in the crate, take it out 20 minutes later, praise him. You know, this is your first interaction with the dog. And then he'll be housebroken, and you don't have to do all the screaming and yelling and dragging around. So there's a sort of, I think, danger to sort of seeing things as obedience. It really becomes an authority contest quite often. And I, of course, also want my dogs to sit. You can't have a safe dog, really, if you don't have a dog
right. That
will do those things. But I think it's part of a much larger context of, first, I want the dog to know me. You know, I hand feed the dog. I get the dog to make eye contact. I make sure the dog knows his or her name. I want the dog to be socialized. And I see that as a platform on which I then build. When you have that relationship, you know, if I take out a treat and show it to Clementine and she locks on, you know, I've got her. Then we sit.
Yeah.
Then we lie down. Then we stay. But I think it's more in the spirit to me of communication and partnership than it is, you know,
mm-hmm.
darn it, you better sit down right now. Mm-hmm. You know, most dogs don't even know their names. I mean, if you say a dog's name, you want to see that head swivel and lock onto you. Most dogs think their names are Susie, come here, or I'm going to kill you. So I think we want the same thing. We want the dog to do what we tell them to do and to be safe and to be obedient. But I think we want it to come out of a relationship of communication and harmony and of grounding, rather than simply a victory of wills.
Yeah. Well, when the dog, no matter what kind of dog it is, when there is that connection, it's like a joy passes between you and the dog. I remember as a kid having this great dog, and it was clear, you know, she was with you, if you know what I mean.
Well, that's right. I think that's exactly my goal as a dog owner, because dogs like that are connected to people, that understand the rules, that have been communicated lovingly and clearly, they are dogs that are very unlikely to hurt people. Or to hurt dogs,
yeah.
Or to run off, or to jump off the deck. When dogs that are yelled and screamed at all the time and kind of bludgeoned into submission, you know, are not really trained. They're basically more cowed. And I'm not speaking in terms of an abuse perspective either. I just think it's what you just said is exactly my goal of a life with a dog.
Mm.
It gives that feeling of joy and partnership and harmony. And to me, that's the ideal. I think that's what we want out of our lives with dogs. And unfortunately, you know, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah. We got to wrap up. I'm sorry to say we're out of time.
Yeah, it was great.
Been so good talking with you again.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
John Katz has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Cats on Dogs, A Common Sense Guide to Training and Living with Dogs. The book is published by Villard. It is 1:53. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the wheat pit a little higher, the corn unchanged, and the beans some follow-through today after yesterday's gains, anywhere between 3 and 4.5 cents higher for the day in the soybean pit. Now let's start with the December wheat for the day. And they settled like this, 326.5 high in the Dease, the low at 323, settlement price there at 325.5. They were up 2.25 on the day. March futures at 341.5, high low at 337.5, settled at $3.40. They were up 1¾ on the day. May futures in the wheat pit, 349.5 on the high, the low there at 346.5. Their settlement at $3.49, up 2¼. July futures from the wheat pit, 356.5, the high, the low at 353, settled 355.5, up 2¼. And September futures, 263, the high, the low at 360.5, settlement price at 362¾. They were up 2.5 for the day. December corn futures now $2.50, the high, the low at 198¾, settled at 199.5, unchanged on the day. March futures at 213¾ for the high, the low at 212. Settled at 212¾. They were unchanged as well. And the May contract unchanged today. 222 the high, the low at 220¾. Settlement price for the May corn at $2.21¼. Once again, they were unchanged. July futures, 229 the high, the low at 227¼. Settlement price at 228¼. They were up a quarter on the day. And the September futures in the corn pit, 236¾, the high, the low at 235¾. Settlement at 235¾, and they were down a quarter on the day. December futures for next year, 246.5, the high, the low at 245¼, settlement price at 245.5, and the December contract for next year finished down a half cent for the day. Soy complex, November beans, 582, the high, the low at 575, settlement price at $5.78. They were up 3 on the day. January futures up 2¾ today, 594 the high. The low there at $5.88, settlement price at $5.90¼, up 2¾. March futures, 602.5, the high, the low at $5.97, settled $5.99, they were up 2¾. In the May, soybeans, 608, the high, the low at 2.5, settlement price at $6.04, they were up 2.5 on the day. July, 614, the high, the low at 608. settled 6.10 1/4, up 3 cents in the August bean, 6.13 the high, the low at 6.08, settlement price at $6.09, up 4. November soybean 6.16 1/2, the high, the low at 11.5, and a settlement price for the November next year contract 6.14 1/2, up 3 1/4. December bean meal futures 171.90, the high, the low at 170.20, settlement price at 170.90, they were up 1 for the day, and the January bean meal up 90 at 172.50, settlement price with a high of 73.50 and a low at 172.20. Bean oil futures 24.05, the high, the low at 23.63, settlement price at 23.78. They were up 2 for the day, and the January bean oil 24.24, the high, the low at 23.85, settlement price at $24 even. They were down a penny. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Mostly higher day today on the Merc. October feeder cattle, the high 116.15, the low 115.60, the settlement 115.75, that down 10. November 114.75, the high 114.10, the low 114.27.5, the settlement, that up 37.5. January feeder cattle 113.05, the high, the low 112.20, the settlement 112.65, that up 75. October live cattle 89.30, the high 88.55, the low, the settlement 88.85, that up 47.5. December live cattle 91.45, the high, the low 90.10, the settlement 90.70, that up 70. December lean hog 61.30, the high 60.35, the low 61.20, the settlement, that up 25. February 64.70, the high 63.65, the low 64.65, the settlement, that up 37.5. April lean hog 65.15, the high 64.27.5, the low, the settlement 64.90, that down a nickel. May lean hogs, today's high 65.77.5, the low 65.30, the settlement 65.62.5, that up 2.5. And February pork bellies, the high today was 90.20, the low 87.75, the settlement 88.35, that up 60 cents. The Dow is down 41 points at 10,344. The S&P 500 off 7 at 1193. And the NASDAQ down 16 points at 2100.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Off the coast of Alabama, the residents of Dauphin Island are planning to rebuild.
It doesn't take a lot of wind, waves, and surge to move these bodies of sand around. And when we place houses, condos, roads, septic systems, you name it, in these locations, we're really setting ourselves up for disaster.
Rebuilding houses in the sand. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving